kid working at a dance station. The lessons of hard work were starting to pay off, but I had a lot more to learn about time management and setting priorities. I had kept my agreement with my mother that if she helped me get an internship, I'd go to college. But after enrolling in a full load of classes at Borough of Manhattan Community College, I was failing. Between school and the radio station, I clearly cared more about my job than about my classes. For a while, I did enough to avoid getting kicked out of community college. And then my mother started paying less attention, so I started dropping classes. And eventually, I stopped going altogether. There was no way I could keep taking on more and more at the station while trying to pretend I was going to college. I was doing too damn much. If I would see my younger self right now, my advice would be, you need to sit your ass down for 5 minutes. Focus. Set some goals. Did I have any goals that I was working so hard to achieve? Not really. Maybe I had an instinct that I was somehow going to run into my goal and find what it was that I was supposed to do. But for the time being, my attitude was just that I was happy to be there and I was eager to do whatever was asked of me so that I could learn everything. My motivation came in the form of wanting to go above and beyond because why not? I had all of that young, dumb energy to give. Never underestimate the value of that passion. Too often I see young interns starting at entry level, trying to move up from there with minimal enthusiasm. I have to wonder, where is your fucking energy? You may not know what you want to do, but so many opportunities are in front of you that you can't waste a moment. You will not be young forever. So when you are, when you don't have big responsibilities yet and you have an opportunity, you should do it till your knuckles bleed. You should keep going hard until somebody peels you up off the floor and is like, go take a nap. Why wouldn't you? While I was in that zone of hyper energy, working in the office, getting coffee, being on the street team, driving vans, I had to drive one of the radio personalities, Deborah Rath, all the way to Great Adventure for an event she was hosting. Tall and thin and blonde, Deborah was known for playing dance music and did a lot of events like this. The drill was that after driving her in the Hot 97 van more than 60 miles to Great Adventure, I was supposed to drive back to Manhattan and then down to some dead-end, rat-infested parking lot in Midtown. When I parked there, I would stomp my feet so the rats wouldn't come running my way. As usual on that particular day, after driving back from Great Adventure, I was supposed to park the van in that nasty lot. Well, I had been going nonstop from school to work and back to work again. I was on no sleep. And that next morning, I was supposed to pick up the van and show up at another event. So instead of putting the van in the lot for a few hours, I thought, I'll keep it. Go home, get a bit of sleep. It was against the rules for a street team member to do that, but I was exhausted. It was the only thing that made sense. I had to. At that point, I lived on the Upper West Side with my mom. I was still living at home, not even a full adult yet. What a relief when I drive the van home, go inside, and go to sleep. But as soon as I wake up and go outside to get going, what a shock. There's an ominous piece of paper on the windshield of the van. Holy shit, I got a ticket. Obviously, when the station received notice of the parking ticket, they'd know that I'd kept the van. But for some dumbass reason, I just didn't tell them. And I waited until they got the ticket in the mail. Maybe I was hoping it would never come. Cut to a few weeks later. Angie. Did you take the van home? You know that's against the rules. I'm standing in the marketing director's office and he's giving me a speech that's going on and on, blah, blah, blah. Then he says, you know we have fired people for that. Shit. Two thoughts crossed my mind. Number one, I don't want to get fired. But number two, I understand what he's saying and I know this is the rule, but let's just talk about common sense here. I wasn't confident enough to verbalize it at the time, but from common sense, I knew that what I did wasn't wrong. Well, I knew that, but even so, I was written up and sent home. It felt like the end of the world. A few days later, I got back at the station for a meeting with the general manager, Judy Ellis, where it would be determined whether or not I was going to get fired. Judy was this little 5-foot dynamo. She was tiny, yes, but she could be in a room full of 6-foot men and dominate. She demanded your attention, your respect. She was fierce. She was smart. She was a big part of what Hot 97 would become. At the meeting, I'm sitting there in front of the powers that be. The marketing director, the promotions director, and the general manager. They're going back and forth about how this is not acceptable. It's against the rules. We've fired other people for this. What are we supposed to do? We're gonna have to let her go. I'm just sitting there as they talk amongst each other for what felt like 10, 15 minutes. And as they continue to talk about me like I'm not even there, I start to get irritated. Can I say something? I finally interrupt. Yeah, sure, go ahead, Judy said. First of all, I've been working here now a pretty long time, and I do whatever anybody asks at any time, and I don't want any credit for that, but I do think that at the least I deserve is that if something goes wrong, somebody would ask me what happened. I paused, took a breath, and then continued. I think I've earned enough respect for you to ask me. You're talking about what I did. You're talking about me. Nobody has said to me, hey, how come you took the van home? Nobody's asked me. You guys are all talking. Everybody's writing notes. They're making decisions. And not once has anybody asked me, why did you take the van home? Oh, shit. Did I raise my voice a little right there? They were all quiet for a second. And then Judy offers, okay, tell me what happened. Well, I had two events that I did back to back. Then I took Deborah to Great Adventure. By the time we came back, I only had a 4-hour turnaround before I had to go do another event, I explained. I didn't want to be late for it, and I didn't want to show up at a sales event half asleep. My thinking was I could just take a quick nap, and I know it was against the rules, but I just tried to make the best decision I could in that moment. All right, give us a minute. We'll talk to you later, okay? Judy said. Her face remained stern, and she and the others stayed put, and I left her office. Later, Judy called me back in. It was just the two of us. First of all, she said, don't take the van home. Okay. I'm not going to fire you. My face must have regained its color, but was there something else? Judy smiled and went on. Second of all, can I just say something?
What?
Can I just say how proud I am of you? You were absolutely right. Not only did we assume that you were just out with the van and did whatever you wanted, but we never asked you your side of the story. Judy had just acknowledged me for doing something that turned out to be a pivotal moment for me. When I first saw the importance of finding my voice and using it to stand up for myself. Getting that ticket could have been the end of my career right there. I could have been fired and then I would have been asking myself, what's next? Okay, let me go work at the sneaker store or something. Instead, I learned the big lesson that sometimes situations will come up when you will have to fight for yourself. Even if you're humble and happy to be there, when you have to rise up and speak on your own behalf. Otherwise, you'll be finished before you can even start. That was not the last time in my career where it could have been all over before it started. But without a doubt, Judy Ellis was a champion who saw something in me, I guess. In fact, not only did Judy decide not to fire me, but shortly after that, she also went on to hire me as her assistant. Later, she told me I was actually a shitty assistant, even though she didn't let on at the time. Nor was she overly critical whenever I gave her the tapes I'd record of me doing air checks. Some of the people around the office had been encouraging me to give it a shot. Hi, it's Angie Martinez on your Hot 97. They were terrible. But she was always kind about it and would listen. You know, they're not that bad, Judy said every time. You're really not that bad. Even just not that bad was encouraging, especially since I had given my tapes to both the program and music director at the time, and their reaction or lack thereof was not so encouraging. So for Judy to say, you're not that bad, to me that was encouraging. Judy was the first person to believe that I could be on the air. She was super smart, so when she believed I could, I started to believe I could. So my next step would be to learn to run the boards. Board operators were always in demand because the pay was low, but the job required training to run them. Yet I knew by now that running the boards was going to be my way inside the studio. So I asked some of the board ops if they would start teaching me. I had done only one or two sessions when my program director, Joel, came up to me one day and stood there, tugging his mustache, and then explained, hey, I need someone to run the public service show on Sunday at 4 a.m. Are you cleared? Are you ready to run the board? Yes, I blurted out. I was not. Like, not even close. I had done two training sessions at the most, but I was so excited to have the opportunity that I jumped out the window with a bold-faced lie. Yes, Joel, I'm ready. I could do it. Running the board involved knowing how to start the reel, stop it at a certain time, and play the commercials. I had done those couple of training sessions, but I was all over the place. Seriously, I had no idea what the hell I was doing. But this opportunity was too important to let that stop me. I showed up that Sunday morning at 4 a.m. as Curtis Elder was getting off of his shift. In his glasses and comfortable sweaters, Curtis always reminded me of a wise older soul. A seasoned board op, he had been there since 10 p.m. the previous night, but was nice enough to help me set up for my shift. I'm sure it didn't take more than a minute for him to see that I had no clue what I was doing. As I took everything in, I was overwhelmed. The boards with all those buttons and switches, everything looked so big and complicated, like I was about to operate an airplane. Holy shit, I'm gonna totally fuck this up. Curtis could clearly tell that I was nervous, that I wasn't ready. He calmly asked, "Well, do you know how to link up the reel?" Kind of. So without confessing that I'm clueless, I'm trying to set up the reel-to-reel machine, inserting the two reels of tape onto the spindles, queued up at just the right spots. It's falling off the thing and the tape is not latching on properly. Nothing is happening right. Curtis felt so bad for me that he wound up staying with me the whole shift. He walked me through the entire show and gave me a crash course in how to run a board properly. By the next time I came on to run the boards, I was more comfortable. And from then, I started doing it all the time. But that first night, literally, we could have had dead air for 4 hours. The public service show would have never aired. And they would have never given me a chance to do that again. Man, people like Curtis are rare. He didn't get paid for those hours. And he never ratted me out. That type of kindness will get me watery-eyed every time. He saved me that night. Once again, it could have been over before it began. By the early 1990s, when I was 19 or 20 years old, at the same time that I was starting to think maybe I'd found my direction in radio, Hot 97 had started to question its musical direction. The question was answered when the station brought in a new program director, Steve Smith, and everyone at the top had this epiphany that New York was the market, if anywhere, where a full-time hip-hop radio station could thrive. I don't know what led them to that or what business meeting it was said that we could build the radio station around hip hop. Steve Smith, a tall white guy with a big head of curly blonde hair, was not what you'd expect as the person to lead that charge. But who was? The concept didn't even exist, as far as I knew. So when the whisperings of it started, the thought of it was like a lightning strike. Wait, what? How amazing would that be? A radio station that played hip-hop all day. We had never heard of such a thing anywhere. Hip-hop was strictly for weekends, and if you did hear it during the week, it was for sure after 10 p.m. But sure enough, pretty quickly, they started bringing in some possible DJs to interview. There were a few I knew from MTV and other places, but no one seemed official. In the spring of 1992, just before Steve started, they brought in Funkmaster Flex, who was already a name in a couple of clubs where I like to go. Club 2000 was popping at the time, and he was killing it in there. With his dark skin and great smile, Flex had charisma and was the real deal. So when he came into the station for a meeting and brought his hip-hop credentials with him, I started to believe. Wow, they might be serious here. The first thing I said about Flex was, he's good. He's a real hip-hop DJ. And when they announced they were hiring him, I knew this was starting to get real. This was the first step in creating the first ever hip-hop station, and I couldn't believe how lucky I was to be in the middle of it all. Though by no means did it happen overnight. Slowly but surely, it became apparent that the decision to bring Flex to Hot 97 had been the right move at the right time. People were tuning in. People were talking about Hot and believing that Steve Smith was onto something. But there was also tremendous pushback. While Steve battled for a transition into full-time hip-hop, there was still some major remnants of what Hot once was, and people fighting to keep it what it once was. Many who had been at the station for longer periods were wholeheartedly against the transition. Freddie Colon, a heavyset New Yorkian who'd been in radio for years and was a nighttime on-air personality at the time, made no apologies for saying, "This is the worst thing this company has ever done. Hip-hop is a fad, and they're going to brand their radio station next to it? What happens when the fad is over?" I was young and I respected him so much as a jock, so although I knew his perspective on this was wrong, I kept my opinion to myself. And what I have learned over the years is that this type of change, unprecedented change, is always accompanied by doubt. Freddie's feelings were mirrored by much of the regime in those days, and I got it. They had put time and sweat into the dance station that Hot 97 was. I'm sure it was hard to let it go, especially knowing that it would mean they would eventually have to say goodbye. Hip-hop wasn't an easy bet. That's part of what makes it real. So even as we started to see that it was more than a fad, and Flex was proving that now he was on the air regularly, there was still an atmosphere of not knowing what was going to happen next. As I'd gotten pretty good at running the boards and had been assigned to Flex's show, I lived that history. And there I was every night standing next to Flex, running his boards, excited as shit. There was one show I'll never forget when Flex played top billing. I am from bed, do or die. The audio too, the two's audio. I got a brother and his name's Gizmo. You would have thought I was getting a royalty check. It was like we had arrived at a kind of promised land and I couldn't keep myself from jumping around the studio singing every single word. Milk is chilling. Giz is chilling. What more can I say? Top billing. You have to understand that before this, the programming had been freestyle and dance music all day and night at Hot 97. Up until Flex started to move the needle, we had zero hip-hop credibility. If you wanted hip-hop, it was Public Service Radio or WBLS and Kiss FM on Friday and Saturday nights. But here we were, changing the game. Not only was I feeling it, but so were a lot of hip-hop fans, and the competition started to notice. Kiss FM reacted by adding a few hip-hop songs to their playlists, only the bigger hits and only at nighttime. And they were still playing Scared. For every one hip-hop song they would add, we added five. This was happening, and it was happening fast. And Flex was our leader. Even so, he was a far cry from the Flex that fans would come to know. Surprising though it may seem, given how legendary a Flex rant would later become, in those early days at Hot, he hated talking on the mic. Talk on air? Nope. He just wanted to play records. Steve Smith had to force Flex to talk. I'd hear Steve make the point to Flex all the time. You have to talk to the listeners. They need to know who you are. In fact, Steve put Flex on a you must talk at these times schedule. Flex hated that. He was so weirded out and nervous about it that he would just open the mic and talk to whoever was in the room with him. And lucky me, running his boards, standing there every night. It became the norm to get thrown a what's poppin', Ange? Or right, Ange? Flex would just start talking to me, and that's how I first started to get comfortable on the air and to feel confident just being myself. This phase didn't last long for Flex because once he started getting a taste for talking on air and seeing the reaction he would get in the streets, he got comfortable on the mic, quick. There were no two ways about it. Flex was on fire. He had the tunnel rocking every Sunday night. It was the mecca of hip-hop clubs, the go-to spot for fans, artists, hip-hop label execs, drug dealers, aspiring artists. Everyone wanted to be at the tunnel, and it was Flex's by design. He was a student of the game, so he understood the business. He understood how to market himself, and he was aggressive about it. He made the whole team these nothing-but-flavor Funkmaster Flex black leather jackets with his logo all over them, and we wore them everywhere proudly. Hip-hop was now exploding in New York. Loud Records had come up with the street team and had the streets plastered with signs. Bad Boy was forming and Puff was flooding the streets with his windbreaker Bad Boy jackets and the Big Mac cassettes with Craig Mack's Flavor in Your Ear on one side and the Notorious B.I.G.'s Unbelievable on the other. Flex was on the air from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. At almost 23 years old, I lived at the station. I was there almost every night. Salaam Remy, a gifted and upcoming producer who would later produce everyone from the Fugees to Amy Winehouse, was there all the time too. Salaam wore many hats at that point. He helped Flex with his records and monitored the other stations. Flex used to call him Salaam the Overseer. Whenever Flex was mixing, Salaam and I would sit in the studio all night doing what we had to do while cracking jokes and talking hip-hop. We quickly became friends. We had a similar sense of humor and sometimes entertained ourselves with pranks and other dumb shit. There were a couple of nights when, as usual, people were calling in the request line with the standard, "Hi, I'm Jane from Brooklyn. I'm Tito from the Bronx. This is Oscar representing Harlem. And they waited to get on the air. Instead of putting them through, we'd click all the lines at the same time and create a listener party line without them even knowing. They would all think they were calling Hot 97 and say, hello, hello, I'm calling Hot 97. Me too. What do you mean me too? I'm calling you. Nah, son, I'm calling you. They'd wind up arguing or hitting on each other or sometimes just talking shit, but it was always hilarious. Salam and I would just sit there and crack up. Yep, it was dumb, but we did have fun. One night when I was working in the back office before running the boards for Flex, somebody mentioned that A Tribe Called Quest was coming up to the station. Oh, I love them, I said. I love Q-Tip. I wasn't trying to fan out or anything, but I was excited that they were coming, and I made sure that when they made their rounds at the office, I got a quick pick. I remember them being so cool and regular and everything I'd hoped that they would be. After Tribe made the rounds and took about 100 flicks, they made their way to the on-air studio to interview with Bugsy, who was on the air before Flex. DJ Fred Bugs was a radio pro and had been in the game for years at New York's WBLS, which was an adult urban station. He was a strong interviewer, and of course I had to tune in. I was still working with the street team at the time, so I was in the station's prize closet packing up teas while I was listening on a little portable radio. They talked about new music they were working on and plans for the group. The interview was good and pretty standard. That is, until, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Bugsy says to Q-Tip, on the air, you know that girl Angie in the back? I think she has a crush on you. Oh my God. What? Why would he do that? Come on, Bugs. I knew he meant no harm and he was just trying to be funny on the radio, but I was absolutely mortified. First of all, it was embarrassing and I wanted to crawl under a desk somewhere and die. And I most certainly did not want to go anywhere near the studio. Then I heard Tip in his very Tip voice say on air, wait, who's that? The girl with the long brown hair, right? I froze. Wait, he knows who I am? Wait, no, not the point. Again, the point is, why would Bugsy do that? Now I would have to hide every time Q-Tip came to the station. The moment the interview ended and I was certain that the group was long out of the building, I ran into the studio and I begged Bugsy to never, ever, ever do that again. He laughed and agreed. And that was that, at least for the moment, as far as Tip and Tribe were concerned. After 4 or 5 years at Hot 97, I was happy being behind the scenes and running the boards. Every now and then I get to talk to Flex on the air, and a few times they even let me do a whole shift, Sundays at 4 a.m., or if they had a scheduling emergency here and there at other times. Terrible little time slots, but I was happy whenever they let me be on the air. I still worked in the office as well, doing whatever anyone needed. And that's where I was, in the office one evening around 6 p.m., after business hours were over and most of the staff had gone home, when it happened. That is, when Steve Smith stuck his head out of his office and gestured for me to come see him. At first, this was no big deal, but I immediately knew something was going on when I saw Judy Ellis sitting there too. So after I asked what it is, they both stare at me for a moment. And then Steve says, okay, well, this is happening. We're going full steam hip hop, and if you're ever going to really learn how to be on the air, you need to be on every day. Judy thinks you could be good, and I think you could be good. But the only way we're going to know for sure is if we put you on regularly. So we want to offer you the overnight slot. Shock, confusion, disbelief. My own shift? I almost passed out dead on the floor right then. This was unbelievable. All I could say was, yes. Then, catching my breath, I had to ask, can I still work with Flex? Judy and Steve looked at each other and then at me. Yes, they said in unison. This was amazing. Chapter 3. Oh my God. There is truly no such thing as overnight success. Over the years, I would see that again and again with icons I interviewed who once seemed to come from nowhere, yet suddenly make it to the top. Every single one had a story of struggle and crazy hard work that came before. And most have a story about a time when an opportunity was given to them and they had to prove themselves. That's not exactly how I saw it in the early moments of doing overnights at the station, but still, it was wild to be 23 years old and getting my own show, even if it was at a time when most people were asleep. My schedule was to first run Flex's boards from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. and then do my own show from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. every day. In hindsight, I realized how insane that was because Flex would leave at 2 a.m. and it was just me there. Every now and then, Salam would stay late to keep me company, but for the most part, overnights were just me alone in a dark, empty station. In that dark, empty building on 38th Street in the Garment District, where even the neighborhood was dark and empty. To keep myself from getting too creeped out, I would stay busy by talking to my listeners all night on the request lines. And on Thursdays, I'd also keep a separate radio on in the studio so I could listen to the Stretch Armstrong and Bobito show on WKCR 89.9, the public radio station housed at Columbia University. It was one of the few authentic hip-hop shows in the market, and they always sounded like they were having a good time. So having it on in the background made me feel like there were people in the room hanging out with me, or at least a little less alone. Unfortunately, Stretch and Bobito were only on once a week. Plus, the request lines would get light once 3 or 4 a.m. rolled around. So during the segments of program music, the challenge was to keep myself from falling asleep, especially between the witching hours of 4 and 6 a.m. Every now and then, I flat out failed and would wake up in a full panic to dead air. Maybe it was more than a few times. Fortunately, I never got caught. As I learned in those first months of being on air and adjusting to the schedule, overnights were a different way of life. You sleep when everyone else is up. And when you're up, everyone else is sleeping. This is not a small thing. To this day, when I go through a toll late at night, I look at the person in the booth and I feel a certain compassion for them. That life can be dark, literally, and sometimes lonely. Then again, I tried to take it in stride and enjoy the fruits of my labor. Like the fact that I had finally moved out of my mother's apartment and was now living on my own for the first time. My mother never minded me staying with her, of course, but I was so independent in other ways, this was the next obvious step in my growth, to go along with the fact that I was moving up in the world at my job. By moving up in the world, I mean that all I could afford was a dumpy little apartment in Astoria, Queens. It was right next to the train station, and I could hear the train running past my window all day and night. On an up note, I had easy access to and from work. That's all that really mattered. And the 24-hour McDonald's right across the street came in handy on those late nights and early mornings. On one of those early mornings in the middle of my show, I got a call on the station's hotline. Yes! At 4:30 a.m., the hotline ringing meant it was at least someone I knew. Someone else was actually awake and calling. So I answered. Hello? Hey, is this Angie? The voice sounded familiar, but I couldn't place it. Yeah, who's this? It's Tip. Who? It's me, Q-Tip. Is this Angie? Flashing back to what Bugsy had done on the air when Tip was at the station last, I was mortified all over again. In an effort to play it cool, all I could think to say was, yeah, who you calling for? Maybe I had overshot. Tip only laughed. I'm calling for you. Who the hell else is up at this time of night? I laughed and immediately lightened up. Tip told me that Tribe was doing all these promo shows, and he was always up late, so he would often catch me on the air on his way home. From there, our conversation was effortless. I can't really explain how this happens, but there are certain people I have met in my life that from the moment we first meet, I immediately feel connected to them. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, I pay attention. The connection doesn't have to be a romantic one. In fact, it's usually not. I felt it when I met Sean Pecos Costner, who later became my manager and one of my closest friends. 20 years later, we are godparents to each other's children. I felt that immediate connection when first meeting a few of my close girlfriends. And I felt it that night talking on the phone with Tip. It's that type of familiarity that you can't really attribute to anything but connection. A Tribe Called Quest was touring at the time in the wake of their Midnight Marauders album, which had included the single Oh My God that I loved. While the tour was ongoing in those times after the show or the after party, I'd often get an in-studio call in the middle of the night. Tip and I began to talk pretty regularly about music, family, TV shows, just regular shit. What was weird was that as much as I had been a fan for years, our conversation felt comfortable. I liked him, but I tried not to make too much of the attention, like, oh, he only calls because he knows I'm sitting in the studio till 6 a.m. He's probably just bored and no one else is up. But I was wrong. In fact, when Tip eventually came back to town, we went on our first date. He picked me up from work. I was in sneakers and sweats and didn't even mind because he made me feel so comfortable just being me. We ate Chinese and then shopped for vinyl at a downtown record store. He put me on to a lot of new music. When I got home, I had to ask myself, was this even a date? It wasn't exactly romantic, but we did have fun. Hot 97 was redefining its mission and transitioning from dance to a 24-hour hip-hop station. And they needed someone who fully represented the culture. I was on overnights for just about a year when they started trying me in different time slots. I did some weekend shifts and even did a midday slot for a month or so. And then when the opportunity opened up, holy shit, I got it. I was the new nighttime jock. That's when I felt the difference. The 6 to 10 p.m. slot was prime time. This was a big deal. Everyone was so happy for me and offered to help me in any way. The only downside was I would no longer be able to work with Flex because, as Steve explained, I'd need to give my full attention to this new opportunity. And that I did. I immediately started brainstorming what the show would sound like. To give it something different, I wanted to come up with a feature where I could play new music. I had an idea for a segment where I would play two new songs and then the listeners could call in and vote on which song was better. Salam and I stayed on the phone all night trying to come up with a name for it, tossing around a bunch of stupid ones until finally we hit on Battle of the Beats. It felt right. Salam offered, "Yo, I'm going to do a promo for you. I got an idea." The timing was ideal. He had just worked with the Fugees on the Nappy Head remix, so he had a sense before the rest of the world how dope Lauryn Hill was. He asked her to sing the intro for me. Lauryn was on the come up, so she was happy to get on anything she could at the time. So she sang, "It's the battle of the beats," and she killed it. I could not wait to play it on the air. Battle of the Beats took off. We broke so many new records on the air, the word of mouth was over the top. All in the days before social media. There was nothing more interactive than radio at the time where you could call up and hear something happen live and experience it all together. Radio was the 1995 version of Twitter. Listeners were engaged and passionate about it, and so was the station. Hot 97 also became one of the few places to find hip-hop artists. There was The Source and Vibe magazines, and you could catch Yo MTV Raps once a week. But for people who wanted it all day, every day, it was Hot 97. And as hip-hop culture and its audience grew, so did our ratings. We turned around to see that Hot 97 had become New York's number one station in the ratings. This was all happening at a time when hip-hop was not only flourishing, but when the music industry at large was exploding. Everybody, major labels and homegrown independent labels alike, started to add to or expand their hip-hop rosters. Battle of the Beats gave a nightly platform to new voices and new work from the more established artists. Needless to say, promoters, hoping to break their latest record, started to seek me out more and more, hoping to get their release in a battle. One night that I'll never forget was when I put on the first single release from a little-known Brooklyn rapper by the name of Jay-Z. The song was In My Lifetime. It eclipsed whatever the other record was that it was up against. I was floored by how many calls this virtually unknown artist got. This was rare because part of the reason more established artists often won the battle was because once you've already adopted an artist, their next release sounds familiar and you feel it even more. Not so in this battle. We were looking at numbers we'd never seen from an unknown. Who the fuck is Jay-Z? The answer came a couple of weeks later when Jay-Z and Damon Dash, Jay's manager and business partner, on their newly formed Rockefeller label, showed up at the station to thank me in person for playing their record. They pulled up in front of the building in a white buggy-eyed Benz that had their Rockefeller logo on the hood. What the hell is that? Nowadays in New York, it's pretty common to see trucks and vans plastered with artist logos all over town. But at this time, it wasn't the norm, and this was the first time I'd ever seen it done in a Mercedes-Benz. When I went to meet them, Dame handed me a bottle of champagne and asked me if I wanted to see Jay's video. Fuck it, yeah, let's see it. Dame Dash and Jay-Z played the video on a screen rigged out of the back of the trunk as I watched from the street with my backpack in one hand and the bottle of Cristal in the other. I was impressed. Not just by the music or the video. Their whole presentation was like nothing I'd ever seen. It was clear these guys were different. It also became clear as time went on that Jay was genuinely interested in getting my feedback on his work. As his career started to take off, I'd have him on the show regularly. We clicked as friends. We soon developed a routine that whenever he finished up an album, he would come by and play it for me. He'd come pick me up at the station and I'd run down to the car and listen to the whole thing. He trusted my opinion. He knew that I was a hip-hop head and that I listened to the lyrics and cared. I think he appreciated that. Jay also seemed to appreciate that I was honest. I tell him, "I don't love this." "Well, this is genius." or I hate the third verse on this song. There are some artists who don't love hearing anything beside praise, but Jay seemed to value my opinion, and I was thrilled to give it to him because from the start I saw Jay's greatness. I really did. I was fortunate to be in New York to watch artists like Jay and so many others who were coming into their own at the time. Almost every night I had somebody notable in the building as a guest. One night it was Wu-Tang, next it was Mobb Deep, and another show it was The Lost Boys or Nas. One of the ways record labels and producers would try to break out new artists at the time was to have them record promos for my show. DJ Premier was working with a new artist, J.Ru the Damager, so they recorded a really cool promo for my Hot 5 at 9 countdown feature with an original beat by Premier. It was really good. One night when Biggie was driving around listening to my show, he heard the promo and fell in love with the beat. He immediately called Premier to find out what it was. Premier explained that J.Ru recorded it specifically for my show and he would have to ask me if I was okay with him using it. I got a call from Premier and he asked my permission. Technically, he didn't need to, but I guess it was a sign of respect. And as much as I appreciated the gesture, I said, "Are you crazy? Of course, give it to Big." So Biggie took the beat and made 10 Crack Commandments. To this day, it makes me happy to hear that song and feel extra connected to it. The show just seemed to take on a life of its own. There was no competition in town. There were no expectations. So there were no rules about how long you could talk or what format to follow. We were just freestyling. A guest would come in and I'd do whatever I wanted. We'd talk for 20 minutes or play cuts if we felt like it. We learned and set the rules as we went. Nothing was calculated. Nobody had ever trained me how to conduct interviews. I didn't have a clue about interviewing do's and don'ts. I just loved the music and had genuine interest in the artist, and it happened to work. Ratings were through the roof. My show became the place for anyone in hip-hop to stop by and chill and talk shit. Black Moon, Queen Latifah, Redman, Puffy, with a young Mary J. Blige, Craig Mack, Keith Murray. If you were a rapper and you had a song out, you stopped by the show. For hip-hop fans, it was the first time you could hear your favorite artists on the radio and learn about them and hear what they sounded like as themselves in conversation. There were really no mainstream outlets for that. The artists liked hanging out here, and we encouraged it. Artists like Biggie would come up all the time. Maybe bring up some food, chill out, smoke Newports, and then we go to the club after the interview. This was not uncommon. Where hip-hop lives was the model that Steve Smith decided to claim for Hot 97. It was that. And we ran with it all the way. After a period, Q-Tip and I had gotten pretty close, but it didn't really seem to be going anywhere. Neither one of us had the time. My schedule was definitely keeping me busy. Since I got off the air at 10 at night, that was when I'd go chill with Flex for a while when he went on the air, or maybe go out to eat and then hit the clubs. On top of that routine, I started getting booked to host parties around the city and getting paid for it. The first few times I thought it was a fluke, but no, the offers kept coming. $500 to show up somewhere for 15 minutes or a half hour, and I'm 24 years old. Yes. Sometimes this would happen multiple times in a night. So I was going to parties where I liked being anyway and making extra cash. Not bad. For all intents and purposes, I was living a charmed life, going out in the town nightly at a time when the New York club scene was popping like never before. As just a fan, it was crazy. You'd go into the club and see all your favorite artists live and in person. When you went to the Tunnel on a Sunday, you would see Busta Rhymes, Redman, Wu-Tang, everybody. And then the next day, I'd get on the radio and talk about where I'd been and who'd been seen at the club the night before. This was back in the day when if something happened in the club, people wouldn't know because it wasn't on Twitter. It wasn't on Instagram. There was no social media. Actually, we were the social media. We were where hip-hop lives. So if you wanted to know what went down, you'd have to wait to hear it on the radio the next day. Who was there and what happened? And everybody wanted to know. My career was on the rise. The station was killing it. And not long after Tip and I slowed down, I started dating Gerard, who was cute in a way that reminded me of my high school boyfriend, Derek. He was brown skin, heavily into hip-hop, clothes, and was always up on new trends, which probably went along with his job in marketing at Loud Records. Between work and staying over a lot at G's apartment on East 21st Street in Manhattan, I barely had time to go home to my shitty apartment in Astoria, which unbeknownst to me had become infested with mice. Yes, mice. Horrifying. Funny thing about that was, one of my neighbors used to always mention the rodent problem in the building. All the time. Because I'd never seen anything, I just thought she was crazy. How could I see anything if I was never there? Those mice must have been chilling in my apartment for months before I noticed. That is, until the day I walked in by myself and saw a big mouse run across the living room. Oh my God, I froze. I then proceeded to backward walk right the hell out of there. I called Nikki, who came right over and helped me lay down some glue traps. That night I stayed at Nikki's. When we went back the next day, not only did we catch that fucker, but we caught about 15 of his friends too. Oh, hell no. We were out of there. We grabbed my valuables and threw a bunch of my clothes in some hefty bags, and I never went back. It was time to step it up anyway. I was starting to make a little more money, my career was thriving, and it felt like I'd begun to carve a real niche for myself on radio. In January 1996, the station decided to go all out and throw me a 25th birthday party at the Palladium on East 14th Street, one of the most iconic hip-hop clubs. Before heading out to the party, I had to take an extra deep breath as I checked my white leather outfit one last time in the mirror. All day I had been stressed out about the turnout. More than once I had said to Salam, "I hope people come." A lot of artists were invited and it was important that they showed. But the real question was whether our listeners would come out in the middle of winter to get into the club, especially when we made such a big deal promoting it. Even today, I never count on turnout for big events because in my mind, everybody's got their own stuff to do. Whatever it is, I never think anybody's gonna come. On my way to the Palladium, I got a call from Salam. "Yo, fam," he said. "There was a line of fucking people wrapped around the block. And there are helicopters flying over." "Are you serious?" "Yeah, it's crazy. This is the longest line at the Palladium I've ever seen." As soon as I got there, I see the line is all the way around the block down 14th Street back to like 3rd Avenue in winter. And up above, there are helicopters circling outside. Whenever I'd go to the Palladium, there would be a line, sure, but this, unbelievable. That was the night when Biggie thought it would be better not to get on stage because he and Faith weren't in the best place. And I understood why. But man, if he had, that place would have gone bananas. Still, it was a night to remember. G was there and wasn't all the way thrilled about Jay-Z and Dame Dash giving me another bottle of Cristal, which we popped open right there on the side of the stage. I tried to include him in the moment, but by the look on his face, I could tell he was uncomfortable. This was a tension that I would become all too familiar with in this relationship and ones to come. But otherwise, the night was spectacular. The celebration was less about me and more about a coming of age for the station. For me, it was more about the love, my relationship with hip-hop, my relationship with the artists, and my relationship with the city. That night was the first time I felt they were all in a position to give it back to me. For me to see a real reflection of our connection. It was overwhelming. My life was changing. That night was a definite turning point. I felt like my show was starting to really matter. Chapter 4, California Love. It was winter 1996 and the whole city was upside down. Tupac and Biggie had been going at it and Pac was always in the news, at the center of what people were now starting to call an East Coast, West Coast beef. The previous year, I had been at the Source Awards at Madison Square Garden when Suge Knight went off on his infamous public rant against Puffy and Bad Boy Records. The reason Tupac wasn't at the Source Awards that night was because he was in jail after being sentenced for sexual abuse, just 3 months after he was shot 5 times at Quad Recording Studios. Suge had posted Tupac's bail of $1.4 million, and Pac immediately signed with Death Row Records. While no one was held responsible for the shooting, Pac seemed to be holding Bad Boy responsible for the attempt on his life, fueling this beef. From there, everything progressed quickly. In December, my friend and co-worker Moni Love, a pioneer for women in hip-hop, made a cameo in the Dog Pound video, New York, New York. In the video, Snoop Dogg and his West Coast crew were shown crushing buildings in New York City, Godzilla style. The video was shot in Brooklyn, Biggie's hometown. The Dog Pound said that the video was misunderstood, that it was intended to be a tribute to New York. But personally, I questioned why they would choose to shoot something that could be taken the wrong way at such a sensitive time. And in fact, it was taken the wrong way. Gunshots were fired on the set. Nobody was injured or arrested, but the event heightened the East Coast, West Coast beef even further. Poor Moni. She was only there to support Snoop, but people gave her so much shit for it. Calling her a traitor and questioning her allegiance. She's such a sweet girl. And I felt bad that she had gotten so beat up for it. But it was a hostile time. We were all so young and so invested, and it seemed so real. I didn't know what to make of it all, but I knew it felt dark. And I knew it felt scary. So imagine how I felt when I got a call from a record exec at Interscope saying that Tupac wanted me to appear in his I Ain't Mad At You video. Oh, hell no. I don't want to be a part of any of this. I relayed that message to the record exec, who called again a couple of days later and said, I spoke to Pac and he wants to talk to you himself. So before I know it, the hotline is blinking and Tupac is on the other line. I really had no idea what to expect. I didn't know if Pac was this bad guy people were making him out to be. I didn't know if he was trying to set me up. I had an image of this crazy, aggressive guy. He was a troublemaker. I had that notion of who he was in my mind. But I would do my best to suspend judgment. I was surprised at how polite he sounded on the phone. This is definitely not what I anticipated. Not that I expected him to be screaming thug life on the phone, but he was nice. Humble even. All I knew was that he was involved in this thing and now he was on the phone wanting to talk to me. What do I say to this man in the middle of this war that's going on? I'd never met Pac, and I didn't know what to think, other than maybe he was someone to avoid. I can't be in your video, I explained. Clarifying from the start of the conversation, I can't show up to work tomorrow if I'm in your video. I've got to walk around these streets. I can't stand next to that right now. And that's when Pac started explaining himself. He said that when he was in jail, he felt like everybody, especially in New York, was shitting on him and making up stories. He explained that it wasn't a coastal thing. It was a media thing. You were one of those people that reported what was happening without a negative spin on it. You didn't put any extra dirt on my name. I appreciated that, he said. You know, this East Coast, West Coast thing is not really that. It's not a whole coast. How could I be mad at a whole coast? Yeah, but nobody's heard you say that, I said. It's the first I'm hearing it. Why don't you come up to the show and we'll do an interview? I would love to, but I'm shooting this movie right now in L.A. and I can't leave. But if you want to come here, I'll send you a ticket for a flight, he offered. Forget about the video. Don't even worry about it. You're not comfortable? I understand. I'll send you a ticket. Come out here. We'll do the interview out here. Okay, I said. All right, I'm going to have somebody call you to set it up. I knew that I had to go. I just knew. With everybody going so crazy, it was getting bad. I honestly thought I could help. If I could get Pac on tape saying that the war was not between all of the East Coast versus all of the West Coast, but rather between a specific group of rappers, that could be helpful. That could be the beginning of making peace. Could I do that? I was 25 years old and had so much to learn. But I had to try. That's all I knew. I was excited. I was nervous. I was all of that. Tupac was flying me to L.A. for what could be the most important interview in the entire country. This was hands down the biggest opportunity of my career. After work, I headed to my boyfriend G's apartment. I couldn't wait to tell him the news. But his reaction completely threw me off. All he had to say was, what you going to see that dude for? You going to be out there with a bunch of dudes? How do you think that looks? There were no words to express how this type of mentality from men irritated me. How could I not feel resentful of that reaction? I'm not sure how I responded, but I know what I was thinking. That means all you do is see me as a girl going out to hang out with a bunch of dudes. That's not how I see myself. I'm not some chick that's going to go running up in there in like a tube top and short shorts trying to fuck Tupac. That's not what this is. If that's what you think, you don't respect me. You don't respect what I'm trying to do and you don't understand my intention. My goal. The fact that you would even jump to that is offensive to me. I may not have been able to articulate it that clearly, but I knew he had offended me. And I knew that it didn't matter. I was going. Looking back, I have to say, that G wasn't a bad guy in all of this. He was 23 at the time, young and way more image conscious than me. And because he was in the business where guys often worry too much about what other guys might say about their girl, that was where his mind went. All shit that had nothing to do with me, but sorry to say, was something that I'd confront a lot. Now, back at the station when I announced that Pac was going to fly me out to Los Angeles, there was another concern. Some of my colleagues were adamant, saying, "What? You can't go out there. It's not safe." After what happened at the Dog Pound video, nobody was ignoring how dangerous the East Coast-West Coast issue had become. Then Ed Lover, a host of the morning show with Ed Hot, who 3 years earlier had come over with Dr. Dre after they'd made a name for themselves on Yo MTV Raps, had a suggestion about a friend of his from L.A., Big Spech. Ed advised, "You should take him with you because he knows L.A. He knows what's safe." We made a plan for Big Spech, short for specialist, to fly out separately and be around to make sure I was okay. I barely traveled and had never been to Los Angeles. I had no luggage, so I borrowed a suitcase from a friend. Having never had to pack for a trip like this, my solution was to throw my regular work clothes into the borrowed bag and be done with it. These days, that would not work. Radio has changed so much from then to now, and media in general, especially for women. Now when I go places, especially with social media, there's always this pressure of how you look. Of course, I care about looking nice, but it's annoying to have to be overly concerned about hair, makeup, and wardrobe when that's not really what I'm here for. Although I can't front, looking back, it would have been nice to wear something better than the Nautica t-shirt I'd chosen to throw on. The magnitude of what was happening didn't quite hit me until I boarded the airplane. I'd never flown first class before, and now I'm sitting in this big seat in the front of the plane in my squishy windbreaker sweats, reading through a stack of hip-hop magazines. Preparing for the interview, I was just trying to wrap my brain around everything that had happened up to that point. According to the articles, Pac had accused Biggie and Bad Boy Records CEO Sean Puffy Combs of being somehow involved in the incident where Pac was robbed and shot 5 times in the lobby of Quad Recording Studios in New York City in November 1994. That I knew. I also knew that Suge Knight had gotten shot at a party in Atlanta, and there was speculation that Puffy was involved. I knew people were taking sides. In his first release post-prison, Pac had delivered a video for his new single, California Love, featuring Dr. Dre. And it was so dope. So well done and over the top. As a New Yorker, I couldn't help but feel a little salty watching Pac throw up West Side W's with his fingers in an aggressive, big-budget, national way. When I first heard the song, and for months after, it irritated the hell out of me. Because I took it as a diss to my city. California knows how to party. Please understand that today as a grown-up, I realize how nuts that sounds. But in the moment, it felt very real. The truth is, California Love wasn't a diss record at all. But there was no confusion 4 months later when Pac released the real diss song, Hit 'Em Up. First off, fuck your bitch and the clique you claim. West Side, when we ride, come equipped with game. Like I said, shit was crazy. Before I knew it, I'm landing in LAX and being greeted by Tupac's assistant, Mindy. A cute, thin, blonde-haired girl. Not exactly what I expected. Later, I learned that Pac actually had a lot of women around him that handled his day-to-day. That surprised me. Mindy was sweet, organized, and super efficient, and let me know as soon as I landed that he was busy just then on the set of a movie he was shooting. He said for me to take you to the hotel, for you to get settled, and then I'll come back and pick you up tomorrow. Mindy explained as soon as I buckled my seatbelt. He's trying to knock out everything and move things around so he could block out the day for you tomorrow and have a lot of time. He's really excited to talk to you. He kept asking, did Angie get in? Is she here? As I'm hearing her say this, again, I'm reminded of the magnitude of this interview. Blue skies, bright sunshine, palm trees everywhere. We pulled up to the Hotel Nico on La Cienega Boulevard, and it looked imposing, beautiful, huge, all very impressive. I felt way out of my element. And just then, I can't help but hear California Love in my head. That irritating song started to get the better of me and became the soundtrack in my head the entire time I was out there. California knows how to party in the city of Compton. Now I had the night to see the city. Ed Lover's friend Big Spech came to get me and took me to the hood where his family lived, to a fried chicken spot in Crenshaw. He was older, respectful, protective, just a nice guy. I got to see regular L.A., not Beverly Hills. I definitely felt more comfortable there, more at ease. Later that night, he dropped me off at the hotel and planned to come back with me to the interview the next day. And so the following day at the appointed hour, Spech and I are picked up by Mindy and driven to a glamorous high-rise building. As Pac's home was in Malibu, Mindy explains, this apartment was where he stayed while he was working. Mindy walks me into the living room and all of the outlaws and Pac's entourage are there hanging out. Big Spech moves to the background as I take a seat alone on a brown leather couch. Sit tight, I'll be right back. He's almost ready, Mindy says. She disappears as Spech fades farther into the back of the living room somewhere. There's a picture of Janet Jackson and Pac from Poetic Justice on the table behind the couch and lots of photos all over the place. A big neon sign is lit up on the wall in the dining room. Thug Mansion. And there I am in my Nautica t-shirt holding my little microphone. Me and the outlaws in the living room. Minutes pass. They give me a head nod or two and a what's up. But there isn't much conversation happening. It's a little awkward and quiet sitting there. Then in walks Pac, and the room immediately lights up. He's laughing, giving his friends pounds and hugs. He comes over and gives me a big hug. You made it, he says. How was your flight? Immediately, everyone in the room feels more at ease with him there. So you good? You hungry? I had my peoples go to this spot and get you some pizza. He shows me the box and it says New York Pizza. I wanted to make you feel comfortable, he says. I want you to feel at home. I know people be saying bad shit about me. I'm a good guy. I laugh and nod, making sure I'm ready to go when he is, checking the batteries on my handheld recorder with a microphone attached to it. I didn't have a video camera, sound equipment, or anything fancy. It was just this tiny little recorder with a microphone and my list of notes from the plane. Pac isn't in a hurry, though. Soon we're eating pizza, somebody lights a blunt, and now the room is starting to feel comfortable. Pac's smoking Newports, people are passing the blunt, and there's a lot of smoke in the room. He plops down on the couch next to me and says, all right, you ready to do this? I fumbled with the tape, hit record, and so it began. I'm sitting here with Tupac in his crib right now. If we get anything positive out of this, then it's more than worth it. First thing I think we need to talk about is this East Coast, West Coast thing. That's really what's on people's minds in New York right now in terms of you. A lot of people feel like you kind of flipped on them.
I don't know why people could feel like I'm flipping on them, because I'm trying to give it up to where I'm from.
But aren't you from New York?
That's where I was born. But that's not where I learned how to make money. When I came out to the West Coast, this is where I got laced. This is where I learned. This is where I became a man.
Right from the start, I could see that he was far more articulate and calculated than I was. And at that point, way more seasoned than me. I could have asked him anything. He already knew what he wanted to say. He answered my questions, but he was very clear about what he wanted to get out of this. He had some shit to say, and he was using me as the vehicle to do that. So are you saying that you do not have a beef with New York?
Nah, I have beef with anybody in my way. Anybody that'll come against me that feel like they could criticize me because they bought my album. That feel like just because they read an interview that they know who I am. I have beef with them interfering with me getting my money. I got a beef with Wendy Williams saying I got raped in jail because that disrespected me, my family, and what I represent. I got a beef with New York rappers just saying whatever they want to say about where I'm from.
He went off, continuing his laundry list, which finally came around to the main beef. And because I still didn't fully understand, I asked exactly how his relationship with Biggie had gotten so bad and what exactly Biggie had done.
He acted like he didn't know what happened when I got shot. He didn't know what happened. I was tripping out. I was bugging. I must have been fucking on drugs when I got operated on. This nigga only got shot once. He was acting like a movie when he came upstairs. That type of shit? It's going down. Puffy's the one that really snapped me back to my senses. When this punk motherfucker said, thug life, you gonna be a thug. You gotta be a thug forever. You can't go in and out of it. Okay. Now when a cream puff nigga like that tell me that, it's time to ride. Cause I had legitimately just walked away from the shit. I was gonna take my shots and move on. I already knew what happened. Only thing that pissed me off is when niggas tried to make me seem like I was bugging or bullshitting like I just shot myself. Nobody knew what happened. That's what really just made me trip the fuck out. And then Mobb Deep doing shows and they introducing people on stage like, this the nigga that shot Pac?
Where was that?
In Queens! It get real deep and everybody involved know it get deep. This is basically what it is. Fear is stronger than love.
His point was that New York was an innocent bystander. And there was no question where the battle lines had been drawn for him.
Niggas that represent New York, some of these rappers, there's a lot of cool niggas out there. But as far as Bad Boy, Puffy is the head of Bad Boy. He's a cream puff. He's being extorted. So the niggas that's extorting him don't pump no fear in my heart. They pump fear in his heart. I rode against the niggas extorting him. They tried to kill me. Biggie and them watched it and acted like they didn't know what happened. So now I'm going to end his business. I'm going to end it so that extorting niggas don't get no money. Biggie don't get no money. Puffy don't get no money. I get all the money. And they be out the rap game. That's what's popping.
And how do you intend to do that?
I'm doing it. Them niggas ain't doing no tours. They ain't living good. They sleeping with extra security. They got guns out. They was over here panicky like a motherfucker.
This whole thing that's going on
is a military move.
This whole thing is a beef with Biggie and Puffy.
No doubt.
So it has nothing to do with you disrespecting New York. Every time Pac came close to giving me something concrete that I could use to defuse the East Coast, West Coast beef, he'd back off and say something even more inflammatory instead. But what I think needs to be clarified is this beef, this whole thing.
There is no beef. When Biggie get attacked, he run in New York and say, they after us, they after us. We ain't after y'all. We after Biggie. Y'all just need to mind y'all business. Every time somebody say something in rap, New York is not the only motherfucker that can answer. In hip-hop, there's so many battles that nobody trip off, but mine's everybody's involved in. Why you can't respect the soldier for being a soldier for the uniform that he's wearing? Don't get mad at me, because y'all niggas is not. They punks! If Biggie was fighting, you would never have thought I was attacking New York. Only reason it looked like I'm attacking New York is because I'm stomping this nigga. I'm smacking him up against the wall, and he's not answering. So I'm banging him up against New York walls, and it's like he ain't doing nothing.
So what's going to come out of this?
I want my respect. It's not going to be over till I drop my Nagasaki. They did they shit. They bombed Pearl Harbor. They shot me 5 times, okay? But until I get my Nagasaki, we can't have peace.
I could tell by his aggression that I wasn't going to get what I was looking for in this moment. I would have to come back to it. My job was not to judge, but to still ask hard questions and not be intimidated. At one point, I tried another way to subtly challenge Pac. This time about Faith Evans and his claim that there had been a relationship between him and her. Something that she denied. I asked why he would drag her into this.
Why? Because that was her husband. And I'm his enemy. And she gave me some pussy. I was supposed to diss her. Any real bitch would be on my side like, damn, that's a player for real. But you acting like suckers, like, why did you diss her? She was married to this nigga, and she slid me some pussy because she was caught up in my image. For real, though. Let's be real, though. So what did I do?